I want to invite you to study with us this morning as we think the thoughts of God that are revealed to us in His Word. If you take your New Testaments back out and go to Acts chapter 17, where our reading was this morning, Acts 17, page 747 in the Pew Bible. As Roger mentioned before he read, in this reading, we have the Apostle Paul coming to the city of Athens. And the city at this time was somewhat lackluster from what it had been in earlier times, yet still it was the center of culture, as Roger indicated. It was an ancient city. It was a city where some of the best thinking of men, that men were capable of producing, had been done for hundreds and hundreds of years. It represented, I suppose, in a way, the best man could offer in trying to find meaning in life and find his way to God unaided. And yet, as we read this particular passage where Paul is interacting with the citizens of this city, we see that their religion and their philosophies had left them bankrupt. They were not satisfied with the religious thoughts that they themselves had discovered. In fact, as Paul comes into the city, in verse 16, we're told that the city was given over to idols. This is man searching for God on his own. And if you've read any descriptions of the city of Athens, it must have been something to see architecturally. The temples were magnificent, and it may be that you've had an opportunity to see some either reconstructions, like the Parthenon in Nashville is a reconstruction, a full-scale replica of the temple there, the Parthenon. And if you've been to the British Museum, there are actual pieces of the Parthenon that are in the museum, and scale, you know, drawings of where certain pieces of the Parthenon actually fit into the temple. And it was very magnificent. And there were temples all over the city. And also everywhere you turned, and that is not an exaggeration, everywhere you turned and everywhere you looked, there were statues. It had been said by one ancient historian that it was easier to find an idol in Athens than it was to find a man. They were literally everywhere. And they deified everything you could think of. There was an idol or an altar to all of the natural elements that you can think of. Fire and water and the ocean and the air and storms and lightning and the sun. There were idols that were devoted to human behavior. Every attitude that you can possibly think of had its God. Every even debased behavior among men had its God. Every passion that you can think of that arises in the heart of a human being had its God and had its idol. And lest any were left out, we're also told here that in verse 23, as Paul was beginning to try to appeal to them on the Areopagus, when he actually had a formal audience gathered to speak to, he said, "As I was passing through, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.'" And what that tells me, at least in part, is the attempt by the Athenians to discover God on their own had left them empty. They had already deified everything you could think of. They had built a temple or an altar or an idol to everything you could possibly imagine. But somehow they still felt this inner desire to have an altar to an unknown God. They weren't satisfied with all the gods they could think of. There was something still missing. And I think that these people really are people in any age. And I'll get to this particular point a little bit later in the lesson. But they do represent people in any age who are striving to find God on their own. The attempt in the end will leave us empty. We cannot discover God on our own, even with a desire to worship Him, which is what these people were doing and why they were building their statues and their temples and their altars. But we find that Athens was not only known for its prolific but bankrupt religion, it was also known for its bankrupt philosophy. We're introduced here to a couple of groups, adherents of ancient philosophers, the Epicureans and the Stoics. The Epicureans were followers of Epicurus. That makes sense. He was a philosopher along with Zeno of Cyprus, who the Stoics were following. They were both philosophers from about 350 years before the time Paul actually came to the city of Athens. These philosophers and their later followers were trying to find the meaning of life not necessarily through religion, but through human ideologies. Epicurus taught, and this is going to be a gross oversimplification, I apologize for that, but Epicurus basically taught that the secret of a rich and full life was through pleasure. Now, what Epicurus apparently meant by that was a calm and stable frame of mind, a secure way of life. We might say, in our terminology, enjoying the simple pleasures. To be unthreatened by your enemies. To have enough to sustain yourself and to enjoy the good things of life. That was basically Epicurus's philosophy. Pleasure. But you know what happens to doctrines when the next generation and the next generation and the next generation begins to embellish and exaggerate and build on the original teachings? Eventually it comes to look nothing like the original idea. And so over the course of 350 years, the pursuit of pleasure became out-and-out lust. The idea that if a little bit of pleasure is a good thing, why, as much pleasure as I can possibly enjoy would be a better thing. And so the Epicureans were basically hedonistic. Live for today, live for the moment, live for yourself, and live for pleasure. And so they're on one end of the philosophical spectrum. Do what makes you happy, do what feels good. On the other hand were the Stoics. They're not the Zenoites. You'd think they would be called that since they were following Zeno. But the term, which we have come to think of someone who's Stoic as being very unemotional and unresponsive, it actually comes from the Greek word stoa, which means a porch. And it has to do with where Zeno taught. These were essentially, I guess, the porchites. And they liked what Zeno had to say because he was sort of going to the opposite end of the spectrum than Epicurus. These were people that would have seen the emptiness in pleasure, pleasure, pleasure. No. Happiness and well-being is not in that. We think happiness and well-being is in controlling your passions, not venting them. And so the Stoics felt like you should avoid great emotional highs and you should avoid great emotional lows. Don't get real excited. Don't get real upset. Learn to live in harmony with what happens. Accept it. Look for the deeper meaning in it if you can find it. But above all, keep your passions under control. Well, you can see probably what that would lead to over the course of time. It would lead to apathy and indifference. But if you're trying to tell yourself not to react to things in life and get overly excited about anything, well, that's in time just going to lead you to not reacting to anything and not having any kind of a reaction to the life and the events that are going on around you. But it's interesting when we read verse 21, what came out of these philosophies. Luke says in writing about this, "For all the Athenians and the foreigners who were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or hear some new thing." What does that tell you? It tells me they've not been satisfied with the old things they've been hearing. That they found the doctrines of Epicurus and Zeno to be as bankrupt as the religious doctrines that led to idols and temples and altars. And so here you've got an intensely religious city, because that's what Paul says to them. Men, I see that you are religious in all things. These are not men completely devoid of religious tendencies, but the path that they chose in regard to religious satisfaction was bankrupt, it was empty. And the path that they chose, looking within the human mind itself, philosophy, forget about God, let's search for the meaning of life on our own. Well, that left them empty too. And so they spent their time trying to figure out what new was coming down the pike that might help them get a handle on what does life really mean? And why am I here? And what's the value of anything? Where do I find that? These people had become so lost that when Paul comes along telling the truth about God, it sounds foreign to them. It sounds very strange and unusual. In chapter 17 and verse 21, that's not correct, verse 18, then certain Epicurean and Stoic philosophers encountered him, and some said, what does this babbler want to say? And others said, he seems to be a proclaimer of foreign gods because he preached to them Jesus and the resurrection. Their idea of human fulfillment and their idea of worship was so off the wall that when Paul comes along saying, here is the truth of God about a relationship with Him, about harmony with deity, about the reality that we are going to be resurrected and Jesus Himself was resurrected, when Paul began talking like that, they thought, this is really weird. We haven't heard anything like this before. Hey, have you heard about this new fellow in town? They were always wanting to hear something new. You heard about this new fellow in town? He's talking about gods we've never even thought of. I guess they thought, you know, they'd thought of all of them, built an altar to them, or a statue. But wait a minute, this guy's saying something we've never heard before. He's preaching foreign gods as they heard him preach about Jesus and the resurrection. Well, Paul says again in verse 22, I perceive that in all things you're very religious. But he uses one of their own altars in its inscription, acknowledging or forcing them to acknowledge by the altar that there's a deity that you apparently don't know anything about. Here's one to the unknown God. Let me talk to you about him. Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing, him I proclaim to you. It's obvious. They don't know the real God. When they hear about him, they're shocked and surprised. And so Paul says, I'm going to talk to you about him. And the intent of the lesson really is not to go very deeply into what Paul had to say to them. We're going to make another application. But I will say, just notice a few things that Paul has to say in contrast to their ideas. First of all, in verse 24, God who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. What a shock that must have been to them as they looked around their city and saw nothing but temples. And Paul says, all this basically that you've done has been for naught. You can't confine the Creator to a building. And in fact, you know, that's what Solomon said when the temple was built in the Old Testament. At the dedication of the temple, as grand as it was and built by God's own design, Solomon acknowledged there's no building that can hold you. It did represent the presence of God among the people, especially on the Ark of the Covenant and the mercy seat where the blood of atonement was sprinkled once a year. It represented the presence of God among the people, and it represented fellowship with Him, and it represented forgiveness. But God never, even in Jewish thought, was intended to be confined in a building. And that's what Paul is saying. You know, you got a temple to this god, a temple to that god, a temple over here, and a temple over there, and each god that sort of goes with its own temple. And Paul says that's not the nature of the true God. In verse 25, nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all life, breath, and all things. The whole idea, you know, of these people and their gods was that oftentimes these gods had the same weaknesses and foibles and passions as human beings, because after all, they were being created from the mind of human beings. And so their idea of worship was to bring something to the god that the god needed to be sustained, even at times bringing food to the gods and leaving the food as if God needed anything. And brethren and friends, we came here today to worship God, but we didn't come to give Him something to sustain Him. God desires our worship. He's provided for it. He's provided that we are fit worshipers. But we're not here to make up for God's deficiencies. We're here to serve God and praise God and honor God, not because He needs that to survive, like He's some egotistical, maniacal God who just wants people to bow down to Him. He's a God that's wanting to bring people into His family and bring them into His family by honoring and serving and worshiping and understanding who He is and rightfully adoring Him. But it's not that God's got an itch that we're here to scratch. And here's this concept as Paul looks around and he sees these people thinking that the gods dwell in buildings that you got to take food to. He says, that's not the true God. We don't sustain Him. He sustains us. He gives us life and breath and all things that we need. Then in verse 29, Paul says, therefore, since we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, something shaped by art and man's devising. And he says this in verse 28, quoting again one of their own prophets. So what does he do? He looks at their altar and says, I'm preaching to you the God you acknowledge that you don't know. And now he said, one of your own poets has said we're His offspring. How then can you imagine that the gods, or the God that he's preaching, how can you imagine that you can create one by carving up a piece of stone? If we're in the image of God, why is the idol of a lesser nature than we are? Paul's saying to them, this doesn't make sense, not even by your own poets. The divine nature is not gold, silver, and stone. The teaching of the New Testament is God is spirit. And any attempt to make an object representing God is futile. And yet he's standing in the middle of a city surrounded by it. And then he says in verse 27, God is not a vague, impersonal force that's bound up in nature, which is sort of the Stoic idea. The Stoics were like pantheists. God was in the mountains, and God was in the rain, and God was in the oceans. And these things that would rightfully amaze human beings. I mean, with all of our scientific technology, we are still amazed when we see the power of a hurricane or an earthquake. People start trying to figure out a way to describe the power of what they're seeing or what they've experienced. But pantheists would see God in nature, and God was not an objective personal being, but he just was sort of in the sap of the tree. And Paul says, that is not God. In verse 27, God created men so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him. And watch this, though he is not far from each one of us. Now, you and I know that to be true if we study the Bible. We have this sense of a personal God that's aware of what we think, what we say, what we're doing. But these people didn't. They saw God as being either wrapped up in nature itself, or at least, if not that, some far-off being that really had little to do with this world except to step in every once in a while and wreak havoc on things. And Paul says, look, The true God that I'm preaching to you is a lot closer to us and a lot more real and a lot more involved in this life and in our lives than you think He is. He's not the God that needs to be brought food. He's the God that supplies our food. I don't know if I can illustrate this effectively or not, but in our recent trip that the family made to Washington, D.C., we were able to see a lot of historic things. Very interesting trip. And I'll just pick the theme of George Washington, if you will. But when we were in Washington, D.C., we saw this representation of George. You know what that is. That's the Washington Monument. It's built in honor of George Washington, our first president, great historical figure in our past. And when you're on the mall in Washington, this thing dominates the skyline. It is the Washington Monument. What do you learn about George Washington by looking at that? It's the Washington Monument, but I don't know what you can learn about George by looking at it. But then we were able to go to Mount Vernon. And this is where George Washington lived out the rest of his life after his presidency. It's a very interesting place, not when it's 95 degrees, but it's a very interesting place. And you can see something of George's ingenuity and the house being built. In fact, if you've been there, when you look at the house from the outside, it looks like it's made of bricks or blocks, about, I guess, this much rectangular. And I guess George was one of the first ones to use stucco of sorts. But it's an application of the wood and an antiquing of the wood that's made to look like stone. Very interesting. It was, I guess, rather innovative for the time. And that's what this house is built in. But even so, you can't tell a whole lot about George by looking at the house. When you go inside, you can see some of his papers are still out, his glasses, his books, some of the original furniture that he would have sat in, that discussions would have taken place in some of these rooms of great historic import. And when you begin to look at this and say, you know, George Washington sat there. And there's his glasses. And there's a telescope. And there's other items that he used. You can sort of close your eyes and begin to get more of a feel about the man, certainly more than you can by looking at that big white monument up there. And then you might even get a better idea of George by looking at his teeth. I mean, at least it has something to do with his person. One of the teeth I read was actually his. But the rest of them were, apparently the wood story is false. They were ivory. But nonetheless, I mean, you could sort of imagine him smiling, I guess, or whatever. But there's something that's just a little bit more personal about George, but still, that doesn't tell you a whole lot, just looking at his choppers. But then you might see an actual bust that has been made of George Washington. And now you might begin to imagine what would have been like to stand there and actually talk to him and to realize this is a pretty close representation of the way that he looked. And so there might be a growing sense of the personality of this man, that he was in fact a real person. And in fact, you know what's very interesting that we learned a little bit of while we were gone is when you're only looking at a person's life from a superficial point of view, it might be that what you know about them are actually myths. That some of the impressions we might have of George Washington are not actually true. We know about the cherry tree, and we think the wooden false teeth, and we know about the crossing of the Delaware, you know, and all that sort of thing. But the more you learn about the historical details of George Washington, the more you realize a lot of the things that we thought about him were mythological. They weren't actually true. But the more you learn, the clearer your impression becomes that this was a real human being. And I'll tell you, none of that would compare to actually living and moving and have our being in the presence of George Washington. If you could literally stand and talk to him and not look at a bust, but look at him in the flesh and converse and find out his ideas and his thoughts. And you know, what else we do with historical figures is we sort of just look at them in the highlight mode, the highlight reel. We forget that they got up every morning. And they got dressed every morning, they ate breakfast every morning, and they laid out their day every morning, and they made decisions all through the day, and there were things that troubled and bothered them, and they had the same kind of anxieties that we have day in and day out. We forget they're real people. But none of these representations of George Washington would ever come close to actually being in his presence. And this is Paul's challenge to the Athenians. He's trying to make God real to them. When they have become lost in mythology, they become lost in philosophy, they become lost in the imagery, they become lost in all of these representations of what they believe to be God. And what Paul's trying to say to them is, you actually live and move and have your being in the presence of God. He's not off somewhere. He's not just living in the mountains and in the depths of the sea. God is intimately aware of your life, and you can know His thoughts. And you can know something about your life that really puts everything in perspective. Zeno didn't have it. Epicurus didn't have it. And certainly their adherents don't have it anymore. They corrupted what their teachers had actually taught. I want to talk to you about the real God in whom we live and move and have our being, who does not dwell in temples made with hands, who doesn't need to be worshipped as if He needed anything. And you sure can't capture Him in His true essence in artwork. That's the God I want to talk to you about. Well, you know, we're in a parallel situation, really, to Paul being in Athens in our own society. Our society and the world in general has become so corrupt in its understanding of God that when we attempt to speak the truth to people, we sound like we're proclaiming a foreign God. In fact, we have our own brand of Epicureans and Stoics even today. We've got the hedonists that think that the true meaning of life is absolute, complete moral liberty to do anything and everything you want to do, and you better not tell me I can't. You don't have any right to judge me about what I'm doing. It's my life, and people are so reckless in living in that hyper-individualism that they just run roughshod over their fellow human beings in their pursuit of play and pleasure. But we've got the Stoics too. We've got the people who see the fallacy in that, and then they go to the other end of the pendulum and they want to go out and commune with nature. They want to live the simple life in a cabin off somewhere and just be in harmony with nature. We've got our Stoics today, and we've got our Epicureans, and then we've got the corrupt religionists of our own day who claim to know God and claim to follow God, but yet they have so corrupted the image of God into charismatic emotionalism, or in turning religion into nothing more than an economic windfall. Oh, serve God and acknowledge God and give God $10 and He'll give you $1,000 back. So self-centered has a lot of religion become, and so merely reflective of the moral conditions of our society that when we teach about the true and living God, we sort of get this, you're preaching a foreign God. When we say scripturally so, that God considers homosexuality to be an abomination and not an alternate lifestyle, we are looked at as being very peculiar. What kind of God is that you're serving? Why? Men should be allowed to live as they have been created by God to live, such as the way they might see homosexuality. When we stand up and say that God is not still miraculously active in the world today, we're going to get this strange look from a lot of people, and they're going to wonder what kind of God we believe in. Well, are you trying to limit God? You mean you haven't seen God miraculously at work in the world today? And immediately we are thought to be spiritual pygmies, because we don't acknowledge that God is still miraculously active in the world today, and the gifts of the Spirit enumerated in the New Testament came by a specific method of transmission, the laying on of apostles' hands for a particular period of time to give evidence that what was being revealed was actually from God, to be superseded by the written will of God, the New Testament that we now have. We proclaim that God is not still working miracles. And of course, many people misunderstand what the word miracle means in the first place. We're going to be looked at rather peculiarly. What kind of God are you preaching? When we say that God confines the work of the church, the collective work of the church, to spiritual enterprises, not social ones, people are going to wonder what kind of God we're proclaiming. I had a phone call from a young man a couple of weeks ago, and he had been on some kind of a mission to Africa and working in some sort of relieving world hunger. And he was calling to ask permission from the congregation to get up in front of us and to give a report on the work that he had done among the hungry in Africa. And I was trying as patiently as I knew how to explain to a person that probably had very little Bible background what we were about in terms of when we come together, why we come together, and the purpose of the collective church, and that it was not involving humanitarian projects and whatnot. And this young man became extremely offended. He became belligerent. He did not understand the God I was trying to talk to him about. And he just thought he had a right, as a total stranger, to come in here and to expound to us about world hunger and relieving the needs of the poor in Africa. And the more I tried to explain to him the difference between individual matters and collective matters, the madder he got. I was proclaiming a foreign God to him. When we stand up and say God is not ecumenical, that he does not accept all faiths as equal, we're going to be looked at peculiarly. We're going to be accused of preaching a foreign God. Also, when we were on the trip, we went to the National Cathedral in Washington. Sort of like Paul, I guess, walking around in Athens. It was an impressive thing to see in terms of architecture. But we got a free tour by one of the personnel from the church there. And you know, it just was the liberal speech. I'm sorry. That's what it was. We don't have an actual congregation here. We are open to all faiths. We welcome all people of all beliefs to come into our house of worship and worship God as they see fit. There was no sense in what this woman was saying to us, that God is in any way exclusive, that God has revealed an exclusive truth, that salvation is in Jesus Christ, that true faith is in obeying the Lord and keeping His commandments, as Jesus Himself said. There was absolutely no sense in the speech of this woman that she gave to us that there was anything at all exclusive about the truth of God. But the National Cathedral is for all beliefs, all faiths, all practices. And so when we stand up and say God is not ecumenical and God has revealed the truth and He does expect us to hold to the truth, we're going to be looked at as if we're proclaiming a foreign God. Whatever it may be, God created, we're going to be looked at in a strange way by religionists and secularists alike. Because so often, again, religion has sold out to the culture around us. But God did create. God created out of nothing. Matter has not always been here. It demonstrates characteristics that to a scientifically thinking person should suggest matter is not eternal. And there is a degree of order and precision in the things that have been made that should lead us to a maker, as Paul is trying to even get across to the Athenians, and yet their response is, you're a proclaimer of foreign gods. Even later, you remember when Paul stands before Festus and talks to him and Agrippa about the truth of Jesus Christ and the resurrection. Festus says, Paul, your great learning is driving you mad. You're crazy to believe what you believe. And Paul says, I'm not crazy, Festus. I speak the words of truth and reason. But friends, the words of truth and reason have been lost in our society about what really makes life worth living and what gives us identity and meaning, and certainly about the nature of God. Well, let me make some observations and then we'll close. Number one, in verse 16, it says, while Paul waited for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him when he saw that the city was given over to idols. This is interesting, the word provoke here. It does not mean that Paul was just a little bothered. The word means burning indignation, and it's in the imperfect tense, which means it continued. Paul remained in burning indignation because of what he saw and what he heard when he looked around himself in Athens. And the question I'd like for us to think about here is, how do we react to the philosophies of our day? How do we feel about the false religion of our day that has obscured the truth of God, that has glorified immorality, that has undoubtedly taken captive some people that you love and I love? How do we feel about that? Sometimes we pride ourselves on not being bothered about the sinful things we see and hear around us. We think that's a badge of honor. Oh, I can listen to that and it doesn't bother me. Well, I can be exposed to that and it doesn't bother me. Well, I've just learned to live, you know, in this horrible, immoral world that we're in. I've just learned to get along with it. That is not a badge of honor. That is a white flag of surrender. When Paul saw what he saw, his spirit was provoked. And he felt like, I can't be silent about what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing. And I wonder, in this matter, have we become so sophisticated that we've become the Stoics? Have we become the followers of Zeno here? That we can consider all of the junk that we're living in and all of the tripe that comes out of people's mouths and just say, oh, well, you know, I'm above that. I've heard it all, seen it all, you know. That just doesn't bother me anymore. Well, brethren, it's got to bother us. It's got to bother us. And if it doesn't, there ought to be warning bells going off all over the place. That it no longer bothers. I'll tell you, if it no longer bothers us, we're no longer going to have any impetus to say anything about it. Or try to neutralize it, or offset it, or save the people that are caught up in it. Secondly, in verse 18, we notice that Paul was referred to as a babbler. Verse 18, some said, what does this babbler want to say? That particular word is a word that actually technically means seed picker. And you can have the idea of a little sparrow, a little bird. You're sitting on a park bench, and you got this little bird, and he's hop, 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 and he's hopping around, and he kind of picks the grass here, and he picks the grass there, and he gets maybe a little bug over here, and he goes gets a little piece of bread that somebody dropped from the lunch over there, and he's just hopping around trying to find something to eat. And then that whole notion began to be descriptive of poor people who went scavenging around for something to eat, scraps that other people had dropped. But applied to Paul, it's an insult to his intelligence. What is this guy? What, is he just gone around picking up everybody else's philosophical scraps? That's what they're saying about him. You're not of the intelligent class. We can see that, probably by the way you dress and by the way you speak. Remember, Paul wasn't apparently very eloquent. And so they want to know, who is this philosophical wannabe? Where did he come up with this stuff that he's spouting off? When they say, we want to hear more about this, we kind of read into that some nobility. Oh, this is really interesting. We want to hear more about this. When in fact, the truth very well may be, is this guy proclaiming foreign gods to the degree we can put him on trial? Some have suggested that what happens on the Areopagus is a preliminary hearing. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if we should take it that far. But they have no respect for Paul. They're curious. They want to hear some new thing. But it's not because they respect necessarily what Paul has said. And he's considered to be an itinerant, scavenging philosopher. How do you react when people speak about you that way or to you that way? When you've tried to talk to them or you've tried to set right some wrong notion or impression that they've got, and you've just been hammered. You've been insulted in some way. How do you respond to that? The world around us is becoming so distant from the truth. Brethren, we need to develop, we must develop to some degree what I'll call controlled aggressiveness. Not aggressiveness of pride, certainly not demeaning anyone else. But I'm going to tell you, the world is going to push us into insignificance if we let it. If we think we're above trying to argue the case with people, if we're not provoked in our spirit anymore, and if we're so shy and timid that when we're called a seed picker, we tuck our tails between our legs and run, we don't want to get into a debate, we don't want to get into a discussion, if that has become our attitude, evil will win. And we may lose our souls in the process. It is incredible to think of the courage. You remember, Paul is alone. His traveling companions aren't with him. He's by himself in Athens. And now he's surrounded by the Areopagites, the judges that actually sit and hear cases on the hill of Mars, Mars Hill. He's on the hill of an idol, Mars, preaching the gospel, preaching the truth. An itinerant seed picker, preaching the truth about God and hearing people say, "This is the biggest bunch of babbling and I've never heard such strange things." We cannot afford to be put off by people that are going to resist us because what they're hearing is so strange from what society in general is telling them. And then finally, Paul remained focused on the true issues. He was preaching repentance. Verse 30, "Truly these times of ignorance God overlooked, but now commands all men everywhere to repent." He's teaching them they must change their views about God. Not only just change their immoral lives, which is what we might associate with repentance first. They must do that. But I think what he's saying is you've got to change your mind about how you see God. You've got to come to acknowledge the true and living God and change your ideas. And he warns them about a judgment coming because he's appointed a day on which he'll judge the world in righteousness by the man whom he's ordained. He has given assurance of this to all by raising him from the dead. He goes back to the idea of resurrection. Remember, the Jews are going to call him on the carpet about that later. Especially the Sadducees that didn't believe in the resurrection. Paul stuck to the story. And central to the story was Jesus. Back in verse 18, they called him a proclaimer of foreign gods because he preached to them Jesus and the resurrection. Let me tell you, this has to do with a man. This whole thing that we stand for, it has to do with a man. His name is not Muhammad. And his name is not Zeno. And his name is not Epicurus. And his name does not change when he takes over the papacy. This is about a man, but his name is Jesus. And we've got to be unashamed about that, and we've got to be bold about it. And we've got to determine somewhere in our hearts that when we hear untruth and ungodliness, and we understand that it's taking people captive, and the name of God is being sullied, and the character of God is being discredited, we have got to have burning indignation within our hearts, and a desire to make it right as best we can. That's what made Paul, Paul. And that's what's going to make us an effective and a visible force in Atlanta. You know, we can send financial resources to men preaching the gospel around the world, and we do, and that's a good thing. But sending money to Germany, sending money to South Africa, sending money to Brazil is not going to help us in Atlanta preach the gospel. That's going to come down to me and you having the courage to speak up and be heard. And that may mean approaching our brethren who are showing signs of weakness, showing signs that they're losing the idea of who Jesus is. It may be that we're having to try to defend the true nature of God among our co-workers that have long ago lost any semblance of God's real being. Brethren, we cannot just compromise and make friends with the world to the point that we're no longer bothered and we no longer speak. What a tremendous example Paul is in so many places that he goes, but here in Athens, to give us the courage to speak up and defend the truth and defend God as we should. After Paul spoke in Acts chapter 17, you know, we don't read about a church being established here. We do read that there were some people who listened. But a lot of people didn't and rejected the message. And so, as a part of extending the invitation of the Lord to you this morning, we'll ask, what do you believe about the true God? And what do you believe about repentance? And what do you believe about Jesus Christ? What do you believe about the resurrection to come? What do you believe about the true nature of God? Do you see God as one in whom you live and move and have your very being? Or is he just some way back in the back of your mind, distant idea or ideal somewhere that, no, one day I'll maybe get around to dealing with that? Or do you take every breath by the allowance of God and you make every choice under the conscious acknowledgement that God's watching me and God's wanting to see what I do, what I choose? Can we help you obey the gospel and enter into a relationship with God that either has never been established or has fallen by the wayside? As we sing this song, our encouragement to you is obey the gospel and come to God. Will you stand as we sing?